some reading assignments for Obama's transition.
I think you should read any book about our former president. If he's planning on getting a dog, to make sure he doesn't make the same mistakes as they did.
I think he should read it because
it shows how troublesome dogs can be.
From the mouths of babes, fifth graders anyway, Barack Obama already gets an earful from his 10-year-old and his 7-year-old. We're just piling on here at The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 14th, and we are piling on, but it's all worthy advice.
Indeed. Friday the 14th. Feels like I dodged a bullet. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Today, we're going to be taking a look at President Bush and the G20 meeting that begins today. Among the leaders of the world's most powerful countries, they'll be meeting about the international financial crisis. New rules in Russia could mean the return of Vladimir Putin to the presidency. And we're also looking at a law in Nebraska that unintentionally has revealed serious problems for struggling families. Those stories and more. First, these headlines.
It's not looking good for the big three automakers who are hoping for a quick $25 billion from the feds to stay in gear. Top Republicans say the money doesn't get to the heart of the problem. And Senator Chris Dodd is the chair of the Banking Committee. He supports the idea to help save jobs. But he told CNN this morning that oversight's the issue.
Clearly, we shouldn't be writing checks without some clear conditionality of what's going to happen with that industry if they're going to change and get back on their feet again.
Democrats can pick it up again with the new Congress in January, but some say key players may not last that long.
And speaking of bailouts, President Bush, who's defended the Treasury's recent intervention into the economy, assured fellow conservatives at the Manhattan Institute yesterday that free markets are still his priority.
Like any other system designed by man, capitalism is not perfect. It can be subject to excesses and abuse, but it is by far the most efficient and just way of structuring an economy.
A point he no doubt wanted to put in the ears of the G20 leaders that he'll be meeting with in D.C. beginning tonight to talk about the global financial crisis. Italy joined Germany today in official recession, and newly released figures show that all of the countries who use the eurozone, are in recession for the very first time.
So this weekend, if you go outside and look up at the night sky on a cold, crisp autumn evening and are looking at the star Pegasus, just feel a little more warm and fuzzy because there are three new planets NASA and the Lawrence Livermore National Lab have discovered. Pictures of them were released yesterday, which are the first actual pictures of planets believed to be orbiting a star outside of our solar system. That brings the tally of planets outside our solar system to 326. Oil's at $58 a barrel. It's all been volatility. The Dow swung more than 800 points before closing up 6.25%. The S&P hit a 5-year low but soared to close up nearly 7%. The Dow futures are down, so the roller coaster continues today. More economic news within the hour. Retail sales grim is the news.
Paul Naraki up there in Beacon, New York, well, he's been using a sandwich board, right, and going through Grand Central trying to find a job. Give us your story. What have you done to try to get a job? How far have you gone? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Are you ready for a summit weekend frenzy, Washington, D.C.? Well, maybe it won't be a frenzy. Call it high-level hand-holding or hand-wringing or commiseration. But the G20 nations are getting together in Washington today and tomorrow. It's a combination of world leaders from emerging market countries like China, India, Brazil, and Saudi Arabia with the good old G7 industrial nations, the U.S., Germany, and the U.K. You know who you are. At the top of the agenda, of course, is the financial crisis. But how can a traditionally ceremonial meeting actually create policy and develop a real consensus to do something about all this? We thought we would take a look at the G20 meeting that's teeing up today and tomorrow from the perspective of one of those G20 nations and a journalist who's going to be covering it. So we've invited Marcus Zehner from the Handelsblatt newspaper based in Dusseldorf to join us. Marcus, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Good morning.
From the perspective of a German journalist, and of course, we should note that yesterday Germany officially indicated that it's been in recession for two quarters and that the nation is shrinking. The entire Eurozone is apparently in recession. What is your headline as you begin to take a look at what these 20 leaders might actually produce out of this meeting?
Well, given the fact that we have an outgoing administration and an incoming administration and being in the phase of transition, in the United States, I think there isn't that much we can expect. But on the other hand, I think the Europeans want to seize the opportunity of having that kind of a bit of a power vacuum in Washington and to table their own plans. And it looks how to revamp the financial architecture. And it looks as if at least the Germans will come up with a plan that will be pretty strongly debated in Washington.
So you sense that the Germans are going to try to take a leadership role in the vacuum that exists here in Washington. I'm wondering if the Germans are under some pressure to further reduce interest rates. Certainly Deutsche Bank has been, or the German Central Bank has been criticized, and the Europeans generally have been criticized for not lowering interest rates fast enough, and that possibly this recession is one of the consequences. How are you viewing that?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the Germans are under pressure to do something on the interest rates, but I think the main difference between the United States and the Europeans is that the Europeans are looking very much into what can we do about regulation, while the Americans at the same time are looking at what can we do against recession. So I think that the Germans and French that they will try to table something that is effectively strengthening regulation.
But the leadership plan coming from France and Germany will have to be implemented with American dollars from the U.S. Treasury. So it's a slightly strange position where perhaps European leaders are coming up with the policy solutions, but it's Washington that's going to have to come up with the actual money.
That's correct. And so we will see whether we really have an outcome that's viable. I think that's just a starting point, this G20 summit, and we're going to see really something substantial much more in the future. But let me just stick for a moment on what we might be seeing on in terms of regulation. I think that the Germans really want to do something against hedge funds, want to have much more control over hedge funds. They want to regulate the rating agencies. And they want to do something about the gray zones. I mean, I'm talking about the offshore banking places like the Cayman Islands and others. And I think that's something they want to have debated here on the summit.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel was one of the first European leaders to come out very strongly, not only critical of the U.S., but also pushing for international cooperation. Is there some kind of symbolism that's worth noting that this international gathering is actually happening, and how do you think that plays into the situation?
I mean, that plays into the question of the format. I think that the G20 meeting, that's very notable because G20 are representing two-thirds of the world population, and it's the emerging markets that are actually producing the growth we still see on a global scale. So I'm wondering whether this G20 is actually indicating that we're not going to see much more of the G7, that in future conferences it has to be the G7 plus India plus Brazil and certainly plus China. Just keep in mind that the Chinese delegation is going to be here with about 100 people. So they're really going to make a great impression here.
And all of those emerging markets are going to be talking about the issue of decoupling, where the assumption was that these emerging markets were immune from the traditional business cycles, and now we're seeing that that's not the case. But Marcus, let's just get real here on the last question. I mean, if you really want to get on the front page of Handelsblatt, what you need to do is go to Reagan Airport there, hop on a plane to Chicago, and track down Barack Obama, correct?
Absolutely right. And I mean, that's basically, I mean, that's the weak point of the whole summit. We're talking here with an outgoing administration, and we don't know really what it's worth, what they are saying, while Barack Obama is on the sidelines. And there was some hope, actually, on part of the Germans that there might be a meeting between Angela Merkel and Barack Obama. That's not going to happen. So the big headlines, no, I don't see them.
All right. Well, Marcus, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you.
Marcus Zehner from the Handelsblatt newspaper based in Dusseldorf with a German journalist perspective of the G20 summit that's assembling now in Washington, D.C. Adora.
And speaking of President-elect Barack Obama, he's going to resign from the Senate, clearly, effective Sunday. And that means there's lots of rumors and speculations on who the Illinois Democratic governor will name to replace him. Ben Calhoun, reporter for Chicago Public Radio, joins us now. He has a few ideas. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Adora. How are you?
Good. Who is in the running? It must be at the top of conversation in Chicago particularly, but Illinois in general.
You're absolutely right. You know, it's easy to come up with, I would say, like a dozen names for people who are in the running. But let me give you who's at the top of the list. I would say Tammy Duckworth. She's our director of Veterans Affairs here in Illinois. She's a double amputee Iraq war vet who ran for Congress in 2006. She's high up there. Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., he's been lobbying hard for it behind the scenes, considered a top candidate. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, she was actually the first person to publicly step out there and say this is something that she would like. Another sort of oddball name is Obama political mentor and Illinois State Senate President Emil Jones. But like I said, you know, anybody who's close to this situation could probably easily draft you a list with a dozen names on it, because this is, as you said, it's up to the governor, and his own situation is pretty complicated right now.
Complicated because he is facing some investigations, correct?
Exactly. You know, at first, you know, the situation, it seems so straightforward. You've got Democratic senator, Democratic governor, you know, very blue state. You know, it just seems kind of straightforward right off the bat. But Rod Blagojevich, as you said, he's under a massive federal corruption investigation. On top of that, he's got really toxic relationships with other state lawmakers, which have left him pretty much alone politically. Recently, the Chicago Tribune pegged his approval rating at 13%. So you've got this guy who's trying to sort of dig himself out of a political hole, and this is seen as an opportunity for him to help himself in some way.
How much influence will Barack Obama have in this decision the governor is going to make?
Well, the governor has said that he'll have a lot of influence. And if you just, you know, the political math of the situation, I think if you're Governor Blagojevich and you're trying to help yourself out politically, you know, you can either curry favor with a voting bloc. You know, Barack Obama is the only African-American member of the Senate. And
right. It's
thought that, you know, if he appoints another African-American, you know, black voters have been huge for the governor in his election and reelection. So he might try to, you know, shore up that base of support. But he also could curry favor with other powerful people. You know, Tammy Duckworth is close to Illinois Senator Dick Durbin. She's also close to Congressman Rahm Emanuel, who will soon be the chief of staff. So, you know, he might help himself by endearing himself to them by appointing Tammy Duckworth.
Well, Ben, maybe the better question is, will the governor have any influence in who's appointed here? I mean, you know, if you got Rahm Emanuel on one side and the important sort of African-American constituency in Illinois, it seems to me the governor really is being told here to kind of maybe get out of the way.
You know, in any other situation, I would say yes. But the thing about this governor is he will make decisions, you know, that somebody described it to me the other day. They said any decision that Governor Blagojevich makes, he wants to make by himself, and he wants to make it his decision. And, you know, we've seen himself take huge political risks and seen himself do, you know, sort of somewhat erratic things because he wanted to own a decision in the past. So I wonder, you know, that's why this list is a dozen names long, because people can't cross anyone off and say, oh, I don't think he'll do that.
Ben Calhoun, thank you. Ben Calhoun is a reporter for Chicago Public Radio, and he's giving us his take on what the governor there is going to do in replacing the Senate seat that Barack Obama is leaving to become president.
I hope Obama finds another gig. I hope so. Yeah. He did pretty well in the Senate.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. As more Americans are forced to start looking for a new job given all the layoffs, we're asking you to help them. We're looking for some advice. What's the most daring or unusual thing you've ever done to get a job? How far have you gone? Give us your story to 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So, speaking of new jobs, you may remember back in April, President Bush talked about meeting his old friend, Russian leader Vladimir Putin, who was also thinking about a new job.
As we can continue progress to find common ground to make the world more peaceful. Both of us want to seize the moment and lead.
As of this week, however, it appears that what Vladimir Putin wants to seize is the reins of power in Moscow for the foreseeable future. The Russian parliament has passed a preliminary measure as of this morning that could allow Vladimir Putin to return to office and serve another term as president of Russia. We're assembling America's briefing book over the next 2 months, and certainly Russia and its importance to the new president of the United States will be a part of President-elect Obama's actual briefing book. We spoke earlier with Stephen Eick, who is a Russian affairs analyst for our partner, the BBC World Service. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. These are very interesting constitutional changes that have been passed in their first reading by the Russian parliament today. They're actually the biggest constitutional changes in Russia since 1993, when the current constitution was adopted. And the essential thing they do is to extend the presidential term for the next president from 4 to 6 years and to increase the term for which a Russian parliament is elected from 4 to 5 years. It also introduces the requirement for the Russian government to give an annual report on its progress and its performance to the Russian parliament. At the moment, the Russian government only reports directly to the president. Now, there are two entirely different ways of looking at the impact of these measures. The defenders, the people around Mr. Medvedev and the former president Vladimir Putin, they say they're designed to streamline Russian politics, to break the way that parliamentary and presidential electoral campaigns currently run almost simultaneously, which they say just completely throws the public and means that real politics can't be done for about a year every 4 years. The opponents of the measures say yet more initiatives aimed at shoring up long-term support for two individuals, for Dmitry Medvedev and Vladimir Putin, further deepening and reinforcing authoritarianism in Russia and making a mockery of democracy.
Although, Stephen, it should be said that electorally, continuity in the Russian government is a popular notion in Russia, even if Putin staying on for a decade is more controversial.
That's very true. The two key words that characterized the presidential campaign when Dmitry Medvedev was elected effectively as Vladimir Putin's successor, chosen successor, were continuity and stability. It is also true that the liberal opposition parties are wholly marginalized, not just in the political scene, but also in everyday life. There really isn't a great deal at the moment of opposition, true opposition to the course that's been set by the president and the government that he's appointed. People are generally satisfied with what's happening in the country. The approval ratings for Mr. Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin are extremely high. It's the stuff that George W. Bush could only dream of. High ratings in the 80s.
Stephen, given the lightning speed by which the Constitution was changed, I've read some reports that have predicted perhaps early elections would be called.
There is intense speculation that these measures, they've been adopted in the first reading today. They go forward to a second and a third reading. Then they have to be signed off by the president into law. There seems to be no doubt whatsoever that that will actually happen. But there is intense speculation that this opens the way to an early return to power for Vladimir Putin. Now, generally, I don't think we have any reason to distrust what Mr. Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin say publicly. And what they're insisting is these measures aren't built around any one individual or any two individuals. contrary to what the opponents of the measures adopted today actually insist they're intended to do. But Mr. Medvedev makes clear in his public pronouncements that he intends to serve out a full presidential term, which of course currently is 4 years, and then the scope will be open to both him and other candidates in 3.5 years' time.
Although, let's say that this does definitely favor the ruling party, Putin's party, even if the names might change a little bit. Before we go, I want to ask you about three issues that are really important for the incoming president. If we could just quickly roll through them, Stephen. Number one, is the decline of energy prices around the world, is the impact of that Russia and Putin and Medvedev no longer have this natural gas weapon to hold over Western Europe and Eastern Europe?
They still have the natural gas weapon because of the scale of dependency in Europe. There are already European countries that are totally dependent 100% on Russian gas, but across the continent, dependency is growing, including in Britain. As far as the lowering of the price for oil and gas is concerned, yes, that's serious. Already predictions and forecasts from the government that some of its social programs from January next year will actually have to be cut.
So there may be more dependency, but the Russians are hesitant to use the weapon because they need the cash more than ever. Secondly, let's talk about the missiles, this missile standoff that the Russians have immediately put on the table for the new president, Barack Obama. Is it possible that Putin and Medvedev have overplayed their hand here?
Well, they seem to be genuine in the offer that they've put on the table, which was in black and white. If the Americans decide not to put the missile defense shield in the Czech Republic and Poland, we will not sight short-range missiles in Kaliningrad in Western Russia. They say that they are hopeful that the forthcoming administration will actually revisit and review its the decision of the Bush administration to locate the missile defense shield. But it's in black and white. The Russians won't do it if the Americans don't.
Well, it could be an interesting moment for the Obama administration if the Americans call the Russians bluff there on those missiles. As usual, Stephen Eek, thanks for being part of the program. Stephen Eek is the BBC Russian Affairs Analyst for the BBC World Service. And now with headlines, Mark Garrison once again.
Thank you. 28 minutes after the hour. Some economic news just out this morning. Computer company Sun Microsystems is planning to cut up to 6,000 workers. That's 18% of their global staff. Traders will work with that news in Wall Street in just a bit when it opens up. Thursday was a wild ride, though. The Dow spanned almost 900 points yesterday, hitting its lowest point in 5 years and then soaring up to close up almost 7% for the day. Asian markets also are up today. Japan's Nikkei gained almost 3%. And Sunday will be the last episode of Total Request Live on MTV. And it's a little bit the culture portion of our newscast. In recent years, TRL was the rare place on music television where you could actually hear music and see music videos. Channel's now mostly reality programming with an emphasis on spoiled teenage girls. But the fans who packed Times Square and kind of peeked in the windows.
On the media or something? Keep going.
All right. I was just saying, no, the fans were a big part of this. And host Damien Fay is going to talk about all the people that looked in the windows and played along.
When they were closed, people would always ask me, why are we closing the windows? You know, whether it was a security reason. We had Eminem on once, and he was going through some stuff, and he was at the height of his career, and Times Square was flooded because of all the people. So the windows are really instrumental in defining TRL.
Also instrumental in making it basically impossible to get around if you ever had to be somewhere at 3:30 in Times Square.
You'd
be lost
Square,
in
right.
this like sea
right.
of pink sometimes when they had a big pop star there.
And TRL actually made it into an Eminem lyric.
Yeah.
That's right. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Moments ago, retail sales in October declined by a record amount. That's just one of the economic statistics that has us thinking. Here's our challenge for you. If you're out of a job, what's your strategy for getting back into the labor force? We want your creative suggestions and stories of what you've done to get a job. Daring, unusual, preferred. 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
John, in September, Gary Staten triggered national attention when he abandoned 9 of his 10 children at a local hospital in Nebraska. After his wife died of a brain aneurysm in 2007, after giving birth to their 10th child, and he lost his job, Staten said he just couldn't cope. His father-in-law says, as you can imagine, it's been a very tough time for the kids.
They were upset and resentful at the time. But I think they're calming down now, and some of them want to see their dad, and some of them worried for their dad. He's going to be in trouble, or he's going to get in trouble. And none of them hate him. They're upset with him. No one asks him why, and I don't believe Gary can even answer the question anymore.
Staten did act legally under a safe haven law adopted in July. And his case highlights an unintended consequence of the vaguely worded law that was intended to protect newborns from abandonment. In 3 months, over 30 children have been abandoned, not a single baby. Some children coming from faraway states, exposing serious questions about support for struggling families across the country. Reporter Robin Wish is on the line from NET Radio with more. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Dora.
I understand there were 2 more children that were dropped off yesterday. Can you tell us about that?
We don't have too many details right now, but there were 2 children, a 14-year-old boy and a 17-year-old girl, who were dropped off at a hospital in Lincoln. They are local. They're from Omaha. And reportedly, the 17-year-old girl actually ran away when she figured out what was happening. And as of last night, police were still searching for her.
Can you tell us what has been the reaction to the Staten case in Nebraska?
Well, it's been mixed. There's been a lot of people that have been very angry with the parents, saying that they're abusing this fall. But there have also been people who have called for empathy and said that, you know, parents in crisis really don't have enough resources available to them. They don't have enough places to go and to get the help that they need. So it's been a mixed bag, a lot of controversy, obviously, as you can imagine.
And that concern about resources for families is obviously not limited to Nebraska. Talk about how there have been children from other states that have ended up in Nebraska, dropped off at hospitals.
There have been. There have been 6 cases right now. There's from Florida to Arizona to Georgia, Iowa, and Indiana. Parents actually just driving across state lines and using the Nebraska Safe Haven law. All of those kids have been returned to their home states. The child welfare agencies in those states have been contacted and will be given jurisdiction. And that's another part of the law that's just been really vague. It's uncertain about how Nebraska fits into that, whether it's something that people from other states can be using. So that's just another reason why the governor has called a special session, which starts today, to address these kinds of really vague and ambiguous parts of the law.
Do you have a sense of what some of the proposals are that they're going to be debating and trying to deal with this law that's created all of these unintended consequences?
Well, the governor is calling for the law to be amended to include an age limit of up to 3 days. And when he introduced or announced that he was going to be holding a special session at the end of last month, he said that a majority of senators, he said 40 of 49 senators, have agreed to just amend the age restriction. But as we've gotten closer to the session, there's been a lot more opinions coming out as far as the differences in what age limits should be set. Some people are now saying 30 days, 35 days, and even up to 4 months old. And there are others that are calling for any amendments to the law to include provisions ensuring families have access when they're in crisis, access to services.
And what has that discussion been like now that there's this greater awareness of the lack of resources for families who are troubled and struggling.
Well, the Department of Health and Human Services, which is the agency that, you know, handles these cases, has really argued that there are enough services for families. And they have said that as a government agency, their role is to step in when a child is in immediate danger, and that before that, it's really up to families to look for help within their community, within nonprofit orgs and assistance through family and friends.
Robin, what's been the toughest part about covering this story for you? I mean, have you had any contact with the kids?
I haven't had contact with the kids. It's been, they have really been sheltered from the media. We haven't seen any interviews with children. Talking to Jack Manzer, Gary Stanton's father-in-law, was difficult because, I mean, you can just imagine what these kids have gone through. They've already been through so much. I mean, their mother died just a year ago, and now their whole world has been uprooted. And, you know, when you're talking about teenagers here, you know, the law is obviously designed to protect newborns, but when you're talking about teenagers, I mean, this is not something that they're going to forget. They're not going to be to forget that feeling that their family abandoned them. So yeah, it's really difficult, and it really just raises a lot of concerns, because when the law was originally proposed and passed, I mean, the debate was, how do you set an artificial age limit on these things? You know, do we not help a child who's 4 days old versus helping a child who's 3 days old? So when you
And those are all of the issues that the legislature is certainly going to be grappling with today. Robin Wish, we appreciate you coming on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Robin Wish is a freelance reporter for NET Radio in Nebraska. Now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's here at WNYC with the latest headlines.
Sure, it's coming up on 20 minutes before the hour. New retail sales numbers for October are just out from the Commerce Department. Maybe you've heard friends saying they're cutting back. Apparently, they're not alone. The numbers show sales have fallen 2.8%. This is retail sales, and that is a big drop. In California, a wildfire has destroyed 70 homes in the wealthy town of Montecito. It's about 90 miles north of L.A. Big-name celebs like Oprah Winfrey and Michael Douglas all have homes there. Today, the fire spread north to the edge of Santa Barbara. At least 2,500 people have evacuated. There's a nationwide import alert on some Chinese-made food products. Everything with dairy in it will be held at the U.S. border until it's been tested for the toxic chemical melamine. Thousands of Chinese have been sickened by tainted food. Vice President-elect Joe Biden didn't have many nice things to say about Dick Cheney during the campaign, but he was collegial when on a visit yesterday. He brought his wife, and they visited the Cheneys at the vice presidential residence.
Well, there we go. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, long before the news media's wild speculations about cabinet posts and advisors, we already knew the senior staff in this new White House. Barack Obama has three senior advisors, all ladies. His wife, Michelle, of course, but also 10-year-old Malia and 7-year-old Sasha. Kids in the White House. Kids advising a president. In a sense, the presence of Malia and Sasha in the corridors of power is an invitation to all elementary school kids everywhere to lend a hand, make a suggestion, like a book to read for the new president.
Hi, my name is Maggie. I am a student from Iron Forge Elementary, and the book that I think President-elect Barack Obama should read while in office is Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I think he should read it because he would be able to see a wimpy kid's perspective of life, and he would be able to do something about conflicts, and he could prevent things like bullying.
I mean, 10-year-olds, this is an age when you begin to know who you are. I mean, sure, fifth graders understand that they have a few things left to learn, but they also have seen a thing or two and are happy to advise grown-ups, daddy, even a president. Imagine ending bullying. What a legacy for a president that would be. Diary of a Wimpy Kid, a series by Jeff Kinney, just might become the outline of a national anti-bullying policy.
Hi, I'm Laurel. I'm a fifth grade student at Iron Forge Elementary. I recommend that President-elect Barack Obama read the fifth Harry Potter book. I recommend that he read it because it has just like a lot of suspense, and if you're having a rough time in the real world, it completely takes you away to a different place somewhere, and some place where even your wildest dreams are likely to come true. So I think Mr. Obama should just hop on the Hogwarts Express and let it take him for the ride of his life.
Escape. Make sure there's time for you to get away from it all, Barack Obama. Good advice from fifth graders who, let's face it, are getting familiar with some real-life stresses. Not unlike a new president suddenly learning from the CIA where all the nukes are. Talk about Voldemort. But perhaps some more practical advice is in order.
Hi, I'm Marley, and I'm a student at Iron Forges Elementary. And I recommend that President-elect Barack Obama reads Marley and Me by John Grogan because it's an awesome book. And also, if he's planning on getting a dog, this shows how troublesome dogs can be.
Marley and Me, a book about the world's worst dog. But for 10-year-olds, leadership is a real concern. Fifth graders are just beginning to understand who's running the world and how important that is.
Hi, I'm Molly from Iron Forge. I would recommend that President-elect Barack Obama read The Giver because if he doesn't lead our country right over the generations, that's what could happen to the U.S. Also, it gives you a different perspective on what life could be like without feelings, color, and memories.
The Giver by Lois Lowry, a great journey into what looks like a utopian society that celebrates sameness. It's as though Molly here was listening to all of Obama's talk about diversity in America. But in the end, maybe the best advice for someone starting a new gig is watch your step, like Paul Shoffert says.
If President-elect Barack Obama read a book when he was in office, I think he should read any book about our former presidents to make sure he doesn't make the same mistakes as they did.
Good advice. And thanks to all the kids in Mrs. Jan Kunkel's fifth grade class at Iron Forge Elementary School in central Pennsylvania. Their suggestions for America's briefing book are all at our website at thetakeaway.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 14th. Mark Garrison has joined us, and he's got some headlines for us.
Thank you. Coming up on 28 minutes before the hour with job cuts and Sun Microsystems and retail sales down this morning. Wall Street is set to open down. Dow futures are down nearly 2%, this after a wild up-and-out ride yesterday. There's news out this morning that the Eurozone countries, those that use the euro currency, are collectively in recession. The global economic crisis is topic A when the G20 leaders meet in Washington this weekend. They'll have dinner tonight and begin deliberations tomorrow. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is renewing threats to attack U.S. forces if they stay in Iraq. Sadr opposes a proposed U.S.-Iraq security agreement where American troops would stay through 2011. And it's a step many believe could allow Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin to retake the country's presidency. Russian lawmakers have tentatively backed constitutional changes that would extend the presidential term from 4 to 6 years. And it's a first. Barack Obama will record the weekly Democratic address, not just on radio, but also on video. Obama's transition team said it'll be turned into an online video and posted on his transition site, change.gov, after Saturday morning's radio broadcast. And the Republican governors met this week in Miami. They always do this, and they claim it's about the states or building the party or working together. But in honest, like most of these people are trying to be president. Bobby Jindal of Louisiana was there, Charlie Crist, Florida, Tim Pawlenty from Minnesota, Haley Barbour of Mississippi. And of course, there was one other person who you might remember her voice.
For me,
It was the honor of a lifetime to fight for what we believe in at the side of John S. McCain.
And so they all traditionally say that they're not focusing on 2012, but if you look at their calendars, you find out that they're actually planning trips to Iowa and they have other things going on. And so it's, you know, it's a big party. And so when there's a, you know, and also if somebody else is already president, then they all want to be vice president. So it's a nice place to watch.
Somebody else is already president. And I think I would call this organization the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Make-A-Wish.
So back to America's briefing book, which is our main concern here between now and Inauguration Day. He's gone but not forgotten.
I can assure you that the hunt for bin Laden is very much at the top of CIA's priority list.
That's CIA Director Michael Hayden in a speech yesterday to the Atlantic Council. As far as we know, al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were part of the early briefings for George W. Bush when he took office back in 2000. Bin Laden had been known since the 1980s. In 2001, though, after 9/11, Osama bin Laden was a household name around the world, and the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden and the search for OBL will be a part of the briefing for the new president, Barack Obama. So joining us to add a page to what we're calling America's briefing book is Robert Baer, former CIA officer and author of The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Robert, thanks for being on the program.
It's great to be here.
First of all, is the new president likely to get a briefing specifically on Osama bin Laden and the status of the search for al-Qaeda?
No doubt. That was the top of the agenda. If he should strike in the next 6 months, that will become the new president's agenda, Obama's agenda. He cannot ignore this. And his first question is, where is he and how do we find him?
And what's the answer to that question, if there is one?
We have no idea.
But what is believed at this point, Bob?
Well, you know, frankly, a couple months ago, I called all my former CIA colleagues who had been on his track and half assumed that he was dead and half assumed that he was still alive, living somewhere in the mountains of Pakistan. But, of course, the key word is assumed. And I asked them, I said, he hasn't been up in the air, no intercept, no defector that's come out and told us about where he was, where he was going, and they said, absolutely not. We have no idea. He has disappeared completely.
So I guess I'm wondering if one of the options that Barack Obama will be dealing with as he's briefed on, you know, what to do now would be just ignoring Osama bin Laden in the sense that the search for him certainly elevated his profile and may have done al-Qaeda some favors. Is it possible to be vigilant about an attack but lower the profile of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda?
I think what he's got to do is actually raise the profile for several reasons. One is he can reconcentrate the war on al-Qaeda, taking attention away from Iraq, shift troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. And it's a prophylactic against a future attack, because there probably will be one. A Seoul suicide bomber in New York, London, somewhere like that. And he can turn to the American people and say, look, I've been on this, guys. I've revitalized this search. And he'll be safe if he does that. If he says, listen, the guy is irrelevant, and he hasn't made an attack, bin Laden, in years, a major attack. He's irrelevant. I'm pulling out of both Iraq and Afghanistan. It's a huge risk, and he'd probably suffer for it.
Then how is that handled then? Because everything now is al-Qaeda.
I think there's no way he can back away from this, Obama. There's no way, and that's why he's got to get into Kabul, change the government, reconcile with a part of the Taliban, make it, cover this up. And he can never give up, whether we are convinced he's dead or not, he can never give up the hunt for bin Laden. He cannot afford it politically, even though in his heart he knows it's a waste of people and money.
Okay, so if there's uncertainty about whether or not Osama bin Laden is alive or not, what is the state of al-Qaeda? What would you brief the future president on that issue?
It's in total disarray. It's probably a dead movement. By now, we should have heard from Osama bin Laden, at least a tape. There should have been an attack somewhere in Europe to prove that he's still there. They've been unable to mount this attack. The attack on the hotel in Pakistan and Islamabad several months ago is probably more likely related to the civil war in Pakistan rather than to bin Laden. So, from an intelligence perspective, the man is irrelevant. He is not a threat to the United States.
And certainly you have moved on from a focus on Al-Qaeda. Your latest book is about Iran and dealing with the higher profile and the benefits that Iran has had as a result of the Iraq War. Is it possible that Iran is an ally against Al-Qaeda in the early going here?
Well, I think it's already an ally. I mean, they supported our invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001. They were delighted when we removed Saddam, and they've helped with the surge in Iraq. They do not want Baghdad turned over to Sunni extremists, Al-Qaeda. The South has been relatively quiet. They helped in the deployment of troops into Basra and the other Shia areas in the South. We want the same thing in Iraq. We want the same thing in Afghanistan. And it's, you know, if you can boil it down to anything, it's the war on Al-Qaeda.
What about allegations by U.S. officials that Iranians are arming some of the militants in Iraq?
I think they probably are arming them, but I wouldn't describe them as militants. I would describe them as simply Shia militias or the Shia military as well that they'll arm one day, simply to defend the Shia community. The Shia community in Iraq has been the victim of Al-Qaeda, and they have an obligation, at least a sectarian obligation, to protect the Shia of Iraq. It comes with the turf, arming militias in Iraq. I mean, we're arming the Sunnis in Anbar province.
Right, and of course, Iran borders Iraq, so it's in their interest to sort of maintain some presence there. But I guess, does that argue possibly for a regional alliance between the United States and Iran that could actually end up achieving the goals that George W. Bush imagined from an alliance with the Iraqi government, that this Iranian superpower in the region all of a sudden has the capability of increasing security for the nations of that region and reducing terrorism around the world?
Oh, I think it absolutely does. The Iranians haven't participated in a terrorist attack against the United States since 1996 in Khobar, Saudi Arabia. But it's remarkable in these 12 years that they've backed off terrorism, and they're a much more conventional power. And they've never stopped pumping oil ever since the revolution. They're a secure source of oil. They've avoided a conflict with our troops in the Gulf, with our carrier groups.
And they have a presidential campaign coming up. Ahmadinejad is actually running for his office. So over the next 12 months, the situation with Iran could get very, very interesting. Robert Baer, thanks so much for joining us.
Great being here. Thanks.
Robert Baer is the author of The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. He has 20 years of CIA experience. He talked with us from Berkeley, California.
And we're always on at The Takeaway. Here's a thought for a takeaway today.
The approval ratings for Mr. Medvedev and Prime Minister Putin are extremely high. It's the stuff that George W. Bush could only dream of.
That's Stephen Eek, BBC Russian Affairs Analyst for the BBC World Service. And we've also been talking about jobs and how to get them.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. What desperate measures have I taken for job opportunities? Answer, I call into this show almost daily. I want a job as a writer for your show. Pretty irrational, huh? Anyway, love you guys. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Troy. Bit of a surprise there. We want to know what else. What is the most daring or unusual thing you've done to get a job? Give us your thought at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're not going to give Troy any hope at all?
No, I'm going to.
You're just going to let him go into the weekend, just kind of hanging, twisting in the wind?
No.
Right? No. Oh, so there may be a possibility there, Troy. Take our podcast to go every morning to just get updates on your job search. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Monitoring the financial rescue plan. Who's got experience with that?
They did hire an accounting firm, but the accounting firm, as we identified in the audit, didn't meet the milestones that were expected of it.
So were the purpose fulfilled by that accounting firm?
No, they weren't.
The Bush administration's record of keeping track of tens of billions in the early days of running Iraq is not great. So who's watching the hundreds of billions of dollars in the financial rescue plan? Adding zeros, subtracting accountants. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 14th, and it really is an important question because it also triggers the question, do we ever learn from our mistakes?
That's right. Nobody's watching the store. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning to you and to everyone. Today, as well as the bailout package oversight, we're also going to take a look at Alaska's reaction to Governor Sarah Palin's many interviews the past week and casinos that are losing big money. Those stories and more, but first, headlines.
Investors, fasten your seatbelts even before the markets open. A big chunk of bad news and maybe some hope on the horizon. First, the Commerce Department reports a record drop in retail sales for October, a whopping 2.8%. That was worse than expected and the biggest drop since reporting began back in 1992. Just about the same time those numbers came out, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke told a group of central bank officials in Germany that financial markets remain under severe strain, but he left open the possibility of another interest rate cut when the Reserve meets on December 16th. The Dow futures are down more than 100 points.
President Bush has strongly defended the Treasury's bailout, but yesterday he assured fellow conservatives at the Manhattan Institute that free markets are still his priority.
Like any other system designed by man, capitalism is not perfect. It can be subject to excesses and abuse, but it is by far the most efficient and just way of structuring an economy.
The president no doubt wanted to put that bug in the ear of the G20 leaders. They're meeting in D.C. beginning tonight to talk about the global financial crisis. Italy joined Germany today in official recession, and newly released figures show that all of the countries who use the eurozone, are in recession for the first time.
Firefighters in California are trying to push back a wind-whipped wildfire that has destroyed about 80 homes and a college dormitory in the Tony town of Montecito, California. Four people have been injured in the blaze that has now charred more than 3 square miles.
Oil's around $58 a barrel, and it was all about volatility yesterday. The Dow swung more than 800 points before closing up 6.25%. The S&P hit a 5-year low, but soared to close up to near up nearly 7%.
So take a look at your debt, all right? Is it a tough number? Is it hard to fathom? How did you get there? How did you get into debt, and how are you managing to get out of it?
Hi, my name is Wendy. I'm calling from Asheville, North Carolina. I'm in debt really badly from a student loan. I will be paying about double, a little over double what I borrowed. I'll be 69 years old when this loan gets paid off.
The financial crisis is a debt crisis all around the world, and that's why next week we want you to call into our spin box line at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Actually, start now. You'll have 1 minute to tell your story, how you got into debt, how debt is affecting you, and whether you're in danger of losing your job. Also, how are you managing to get out of debt? On The Takeaway, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we learned from a number of sources on the program this week, as the Treasury is scrambling to stay on top of the rapidly developing economic crisis around the world, Congress and the rest of the federal government are scrambling to stay on top of the mandated oversight for the $700 billion and counting rescue package. Are there lessons for how to do this well? It's an important question, and they're asking it on Capitol Hill. And there are some echoes in the current crisis of those early days of the Iraqi occupation back in 1993. Billions needed to be immediately, remember? Contractors need to be hired. No time for traditional working through normal channels. We've got to do it yesterday. Joining us now is Stuart Bowen. He's the Special Inspector General who oversaw the operations of the Coalition Provisional Authority and joins us now from Baghdad, Iraq. Mr. Bowen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, John.
My question, Stuart, is are there lessons in a hundreds of billions of dollars rescue enterprise from the tens of billions of dollar coalitional provisional authority challenges that you oversaw back, in the 2003-2007 period.
Yes, I think there are three that jump right to mind. First, the importance of getting oversight in place early. My office was not created until over 6 months after the CPA started spending billions of dollars in Iraq, and I wasn't appointed until almost 2 months after the legislation creating the office was signed by the president. Second, it's important that this office be adequately staffed with the right expertise, and that's going to take some time, and the clock is already ticking on this. And third is the need to ensure that this office has adequate independence and appropriate cross-jurisdictional oversight to provide the kind of reporting that Congress needs to know and understand how these hundreds of billions of dollars are being used.
And as you were part of the investigation, the Coalition Provisional Authority unfortunately misplaced significant amounts of money. There was a concern that a lot of the people inside the CPA and even in the oversight realms were political appointees, and that getting to the bottom of that was very, very, very difficult. I want to ask you a question about one of the individuals who appears to be involved in the government rescue package, and his name is Reuben Jeffrey. And he was apparently, according to an article in Rolling Stone by Naomi Klein, which is on the stands right now, the executive director of the CPA, very much involved in the day-to-day operations of how that money was spent. Do you have any sort of independent assessment of Mr. Jeffrey's resume, and is his appointment here a good or a bad sign going forward for the financial bailout?
I think it's a good thing. I know Reuben quite well. He's an honest, straightforward, and very intelligent man, and he has significant experience from Wall Street, as does Secretary Paulson and several of the others who are engaged in planning how to use the rescue funds. So I'm not concerned about conflicts of interest regarding him or his character, for that matter.
What about his record at CPA? I mean, it was on his watch that a lot of the things that you reported took place.
Well, he was in charge of managing the Washington office for CPA. He did not have significant decision-making authority over the lack of controls that we pointed out. And I think that leads me to another important point, the lack of knowledge about what controls the Treasury has put in place regarding the management of these funds. That was the core finding of our audits on CPA, that they established rules, they didn't follow them. Again, with this bailout package, the Treasury is exempted from the standard regulations and expected to create its own controls. We don't really know what those are yet, or whether they're being effectively applied.
And Stuart, what would your advice be to those people who are now assigned to develop that, given some early sense of, given what you learned in some of your reporting, there's a lack of accurate accounting, corruption, abuse, and waste, and certainly not something we'd like to see repeated in this federal bailout package?
Well, inventing new rules, as I said, to manage large sums of money is a dicey process. There are three oversight mechanisms in the bill to address this problem. One is the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Recovery Program. Two is the Government Accountability Office. And three is the Congressional Commission. All three need to engage on this one important issue to ensure that not only are good controls, good rules put in place by the Treasury, but also that they are properly followed.
Stuart, can I ask you a really dumb question?
Mm-hmm.
When around tax refund time, okay, we all get these checks from the Internal Revenue Service or from the U.S. Treasury, right? And mm-hmm. It's clear that they come from the Treasury. If Secretary Paulson is writing checks on the so-called TARP, the Troubled Asset, recovery program, If he's writing checks on the TARP, is that evident to someone in the Inspector General's office that it came from the TARP? Or do all the checks that go out of this bailout package look exactly the same as every other federal Treasury check?
Not a dumb question at all. The seemingly dumb question in the face of the current plan is, what exactly will those checks be written for? It's not right. really, as I understand it, a TARP anymore. The Treasury has moved away from buying up troubled mortgage derivative securities and towards investing in banks, which is sort of the Brits took the lead on some weeks back, and now is studying investing in credit card debt, credit card companies, I should say, because of pending or impending problems in that debt market. This is an evolving rescue package, and who knows whether in another 6 weeks whether it will open up a new front to spend these billions.
But that the point that you make, though,
is necessary.
And the paper trail for how these checks are being written and what they're for is even more critical because the rules seem to be changing. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. I mean, the controls that might have been written 6 weeks ago when this bill was signed would perhaps be defunct at this point because of the change in policy. And thus, that I think, exposes the soft underbelly of the overall process. It needs to define itself and therein have appropriate rules written around it so that it can be managed.
Well, as I'm talking to you here, Stuart, you know, my appetite is really receding into the background here, and it is making me nervous. But in the little amount of time that we have here, I want to ask you about something you referred to a couple of minutes ago. One of the key problems at the CPA was that they created their own regulations and then didn't follow
That's
it.
Right.
I actually remember Paul Bremer sitting in a congressional hearing being told to read his regulation about transparency and hearing how he didn't follow it. The
yes.
exact same thing is being repeated here on a scale of hundreds of billions as opposed to the tens of billions at the CPA?
Pretty much. The reality is that this program is exempt from standard financial regulatory processes. But in exchange for that exemption, the Congress imposed upon it the duty to develop effective controls of its own. Any accountant, any auditor will tell you internal controls are the key to effective funds management. I don't know what those controls are. I'm sure they developed them. But since the program seems to be in a steady state of evolution, it's hard to tell whether the existing controls apply to the new program.
Stuart, you see any...
That's why we need oversight.
Stuart, you see any bright signs here at all since you've expressed some real concerns?
And you want to take this job maybe, Stuart?
Bright signs. I would say the bright sign is probably that the enormous problem that the Congress had to face, or I should say the Treasury presented to the Congress 7 weeks ago, is not the problem that apparently they thought it was. That problem being the need to purchase up all these questionable valued derivatives, mortgage derivatives.
Which either means that things are getting better in the world or that they are changing the rules, and the quicker we get an inspector general in there to watch over this, the better. Stuart Bowen, I can't tell you how grateful I am for you to sort of take a look at these details. Stuart Bowen is the...
Good to talk to you from Baghdad.
Yes, Stuart Bowen is the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, and he spoke with us from Baghdad.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Pay as you go or debt in America.
Hi, my name's Jackie. I live in Santa Ana, California. People are hearing about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Student loans are much worse. They are predatory, they are crooked, and they have the power to come after you in a way that the mafia envies. My student loans went from $74,000 to $192,000.
Oh,
I will never be able to pay this off, ever, in my lifetime. They own me.
We're doing a series next week on debt in America, and we want to hear your stories. How are you managing your debt? How did you get into it? What lessons do you want to convey to the rest of our listeners? At 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Speaking of debt and financial troubles, tonight President Bush begins the G20 summit meeting with leaders from 20 of the world's most powerful nations. They're going to be talking about the international economic crisis. Bush welcomes them to Washington, which could potentially complicate matters given his administration is coming to an end. And whatever the group decides will be passed on to President-elect Barack Obama, who is not planning on attending the summit. Meanwhile, there are some reports that Citigroup is looking for a new chairman, which the company denies. To talk about all of this, Peter Marisi, professor at the University of Maryland School of Business, joins us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So what do you think can be accomplished at this summit, given the dynamics?
Not a lot. And it doesn't have much to do with the fact that we have a change in government. It's the fact that we already have international institutions in place to deal with trade, banking regulation, and exchange rates. And there are limits to what can be accomplished because in order to have progress at the international level, governments have to agree about the goals and strategies. For example, on exchange rates, the Chinese want to have a fixed exchange rate system where they have an undervalued currency, which advantages them in trade. And that is a position that is also followed in India and several other developing countries. So they're not going to go along with a Bretton Woods system that it seeks to balance trade, for example. On trade issues, I mean, we don't want to open up our markets in agricultural products completely. They don't want to open up their markets in manufactured products. That's why the Doha round failed. Moving trade negotiations from the WTO to some supranational authority isn't going to change those conditions, and it isn't going to compel people to agree where they disagree.
Certainly, after Bush's speech yesterday, let's listen to a bit of it. There was the response to it essentially was most people don't expect much to take place this weekend.
History has shown that the greater threat to economic prosperity is not too little government involvement in the market. It is too much government involvement in the market.
So what message did he send there, Peter?
He was really talking about bank regulation in New York. The problem that we have right now is everybody seems to think, and this is something that you hear on all the public stations around the country, we need more regulation of the banks. Lord knows, the New York banks have got regulations. At Citibank, they've got a federal regulator in the bank 24 hours a day. And same thing with all the other major banks. What we've got here is the equivalent of tax avoidance. No matter how complex and tightly you write the tax rules, people find a way around them. No matter how tightly you write the bank regulations, people find a way around them. What just happened now was we had an accounting fraud. People moved their liabilities outside the banks into structured investment vehicles, said these vehicles did not count against the capital of the banks, and the capital of the banks wouldn't have to, you know, back them up if they failed, and they did. And so we're in a mess.
This weekend meeting is pointless?
Pretty much. It's never really pointless. Right now, the Europeans need an opportunity to scold us, and it'll provide that. The Chinese are getting to the point where they're going to have to change or face slower growth. And their leadership is going to have to go through a play where they scold us, and this will provide an opportunity. This weekend, we're going to get spanked. And you know something? Given the mess we've created, we deserve it.
Well, and the West will also be looking at Europe's resistance to reduce interest rates. So there'll be a lot of scolding and spanking to go around. I want to give you the opportunity. Hold on one second. I don't want to get into European interest rates. I may be wrong economically, as usual. But, you know, the stock at Citigroup went through the $10 mark this week. and all of a sudden there's a crisis in management at Citigroup. Is this bank going under, or what's happening there?
I guess you want me to mention Vikram's name. Vikram Pandit is politically very adroit. What he's done is trashed the bank. The problems there are much deeper than subprime mortgages. And his conduct as CEO is highly questionable, both his, how he's conducted his personal affairs and how he's managed the bank.
Let's just remind people of the news this week. The chairman, there was a call for the chairman to be replaced, who is not Vikram Pandit. And then there's also been criticism that Pandit and all of his Morgan Stanley buddies are running the bank kind of out of their own closet.
Exactly. And now, what do we have come out of this? Basically, there's no pressure on Rubin to leave, who hired Pandit, and they're pressuring
Robert Rubin.
Right, and there's no and now they're putting pressure on the chairman of the board to leave. So we're going to fire the chairman of the board because it's becoming more assertive, perhaps, instead of the guy who's running the bank. That's kind of like the problem over at General Motors. Basically, General Motors has got a board full of shills, and so Rick Wagner never was held accountable for losing money. He increased his compensation by over 60% this year. There's basically a crisis of management at Citigroup. We have an acquisitive CEO who stuffs the shareholders' money in his pockets and is frankly not competent to run the institution.
Well, Peter, we got to go, but it's great how, you know, suddenly when the stock is below $10 a share, how much transparency suddenly happens in the boardrooms of a big bank like Citigroup.
And my concern about him doesn't seem so dumb after all, does it?
Peter Morici, we're always so glad to have you, sir. We hope you have a good weekend.
Take care.
Peter Morici is a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business. Now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's got some headlines for us.
Yes, it is 20 minutes after the hour.
Hi there,
Wall
Mark.
Street opens in about 2 minutes.
Thanks for joining us.
I was checking the futures. I wanted to give you the latest information. More than half a point. Dow Industrial Futures are down when the markets open. So now you know. That follows moves up today in Asian and European markets. A California man has been indicted with starting an anthrax scare. Mark Kaiser sent packets of harmless powder labeled anthrax sample to media outlets around the country. Kaiser said it was, quote, an act of conscience because he says the U.S. needs to be more vigilant about terrorist threats.
So now people are going to pay more attention of white powder that gets sent to them? Because
there are better ways to draw attention,
exactly,
I would say,
yeah.
and not having to like keep people evacuating their offices like that. So we don't endorse that way. Start a foundation or something. Anyway, in a separate incident, Mormon temples in Utah and California closed yesterday after receiving envelopes of white powder. The FBI is now testing it. This is after the passage of California's anti-gay marriage ban, which many in the church support it. The EU is resuming cooperation talks with Russia, according to European Commission President Jose Manuel Barroso. The negotiations stopped after Russia war with Georgia this summer. Critics, including some in the U.S. government, say it's too soon to forgive Russia. Also in Russia, the parliament there has given preliminary approval to extend the president's term from 4 to 6 years. The change would affect the next president. The current is Dmitry Medvedev, but many see him as a stalking horse for Vladimir Putin to retake the presidency.
Mark, this hot across the Associated Press. President-elect Barack Obama to meet with vanquished Republican rival John McCain today.
They're meeting on Monday, yeah, and it's not clear what they're going to talk about, but that will be the first meeting since the election.
Interesting, right? According to the Associated Press.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 14th. The Dow has opened and it's down about 140 points. We're doing a series on debt in America, how people are managing it and what kind of debt they're in.
I'm a single mother of two daughters. I was working and making $900 a week. I got laid off at the beginning of October. My name is Christine. I live in Miami, Florida. I now get unemployment benefits of $257 a week. I owe about $17,000 in credit card bills. I can't believe that the federal government just gives the money to the banks. How about us on the bottom?
We want to hear your story. How'd you get into debt? How you're getting out of debt? Give us a call, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, and we'll be showcasing them next week.
Series on debt management all next week on The Takeaway. One of my takeaways, perhaps the main thing I took from this crazy election campaign, was some advice. I don't know if you remember hearing this from Sarah Palin, the nominee on the Republican side for Veep. Forget Chuck E. Cheese, she said. Forget TV. Just take the kids caribou hunting.
Oh, just because caribou hunts are, for me, a lot easier. They're easier to take the kids on a caribou hunt where you're out four-wheeling and walking through the tundra, the area there. It's just been easier. But so how many if I had an opportunity, I'd shoot a moose, too.
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has rewritten Andy Warhol's notion of 15 minutes of fame. The hours just keep accumulating. And being on the losing ticket in 2008 hasn't stopped Palin from being a ubiquitous figure on television talk shows. Joining us now to talk about the reaction in Alaska to all this is Steve Heimel. He's a senior reporter and producer for the Alaska Public Radio Network based in Anchorage. He's also host of its call-in show, Talk of Alaska. Steve, thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, glad to be on again.
So, Steve, when Palin was nominated, you said something that has really stuck with me through this whole campaign, and I want to play it right now. Will you listen?
Sure. A pretty powerful makeover, John. This is by far the best speech I've ever heard her do.
I asked you if this looked like the Sarah Palin you knew or if she'd had some sort of Republican Party makeover, and you said it looks like a makeover. Well, the makeover is still going on. What do you make of it up there in Anchorage?
Well, I think she's becoming more politically mature, and she likes the spotlight, and she's very interested in higher office now, and many in the Republican Party would like to see that because she's young, and let's face it, they need to think about that younger demographic.
Does that play well in Alaska among the people who, she's the governor of? Or do they think that she's suddenly riding a wave of her own making?
I think that Alaskans are very split right now. And she still has a very substantial base of support, but it's kind of like that two-year stage in a marriage where people are kind of waking up to characteristics about their partner that they might not have been acknowledging before.
Oh, we would call that way too much information. Alaskans are getting way too much information about their governor, and perhaps Americans are getting way too much information about the state of Alaska. Steve, listen to this.
This is delicious, the mousse.
It is.
It's so sweeter,
good.
Almost. Isn't it a little bit
kind of sweeter?
And much healthier than beef.
It is healthier?
Yes, much healthier than beef. And that's something else, you know, that maybe people don't understand about Alaska is we manage our wildlife so that there's a large population of the moose and the caribou because that's what people eat, especially in rural Alaska. They don't want to have to import beef.
Now, Steve, level with me here. When Alaskans hear Governor Palin on Greta Van Susteren's show talking about moose like that, do they go, yeah, Sarah, or do they go, oh, do they wince?
Well, I think there sometimes is a cringe factor about things that she says, but I don't think it would have to do with this domestic household stuff. I think, subsistence is a very important part of many Alaskans' way of life, and you cannot even imagine what it costs in shipping charges for groceries and so forth, and especially when you're in a village, you really do depend on the wild meat. I think that's, you know, meat hunting is not so well regarded in much of the country, but it's very much what people do here, and this includes urban Alaskans.
So Alaskans are happy that Sarah Palin is cluing in the rest of America about what goes on in Alaska.
I think they are. I think, and this would go right across the spectrum to the liberal side, not just the church conservative, social conservative kind of people that are her core base.
What about her relationship with Senator Ted Stevens, who's fighting for his political life up there? If he doesn't make it, does the star rise for Governor Palin even higher than it already seems to be?
Well, I think, oddly, if he'd have made it, but it now looks with the election counts that he's falling fairly well behind, and it looks like he won't make reelection. But had he been reelected and then not prevailed in his appeals, he would have likely been kicked out of the Senate, giving Palin a political opportunity there. It looks now like that's not going to happen, but there's still a good deal of talk about what will she do when our other senator, Lisa Murkowski, comes up for re-election.
So at the moment, Steve, you would say that overall the folks in Alaska are very pleased that their governor has been elevated to this national stage and is getting this kind of attention.
Not 100%, but I think there is a good deal of that. But there is also a concern, and this also goes across the spectrum to conservatives, that we really need some leadership in the governor's office, and that's what she was giving us, and we expect that to continue. With the price of oil going down below 55 bucks, that basically is a disaster for the state's revenue, revenues.
So she's got a loose leash right now, but there's definitely work to do when she gets back to Alaska. Very, very quickly, Steve, what percentage of the population of Alaska would like to guest host Saturday Night Live? Quickly.
70.
Thanks very much, Steve Heimel. Sarah Palin certainly knows her demographic. He's a senior reporter and producer for the Alaska Public Radio Network, joining us to talk about Sarah Palin from Anchorage. And Mark Garrison now has the headlines.
Thank you. 21 minutes before the hour, the Dow down about a point and a half. Wall Street just opened a few minutes ago. This comes amid more rough economic news. Retail sales dropped.
It's down 137 points, but it's a percent.
I should clarify that. 1.5%, a little bit more than that. But retail sales are down 2.8%. Sun Microsystems are cutting jobs. Right now, leaders from all over the world can discuss their economic woes this weekend. Members of the G20 nations arrive in Washington today for a summit on the economic crisis. And President-elect Obama will meet with John McCain on Monday. This will be their first in-person meeting since the election. McCain's fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham will be there, as will incoming White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Also, as of Sunday, the president-elect will no longer be a senator. He announced he'll resign from his seat. In a statement, he called his time, quote, one of the highest honors and privileges of his life. It's up to the Illinois governor, that's a Democrat, Rod Blagojevich, to choose a successor. And at least 100 homes in a college dorm have been destroyed in a wildfire in a wealthy Central California area. Firefighters are working to keep the blaze contained. They're planning to do aerial water drops today.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And John, you may not know, but today is World Diabetes Day. Doctors around the globe are trying to draw attention to what could be one of the biggest epidemics of the 21st century. Diabetes, particularly type 2 diabetes, is soaring in the developing world. We're joined now by Adam Minot, a BBC correspondent, and he's coming to us from Chennai, India, the most affected country. Thanks for being with us, Adam.
Morning. Hello, yes.
Where are you? On the street?
I'm on the street in Chennai, yes. There's been a march going through the town today to draw attention to the severity of diabetes. And it had always been viewed in the past as a disease which hit the developed world, hit the United States, hit Europe. But now it is cutting literally a swathe through populations in the developing world, here in India, in Africa, and elsewhere. I mean, let me give you some figures, for example. It's estimated here that somewhere between 9 and 14% of the Indian population has diabetes. So that is somewhere in excess of 100 million people. So it is potentially an absolute catastrophe that's waiting to happen.
That sounds like a staggering number. Why India? Why such big numbers there?
Well, diabetes type 2 has always been called the disease of affluence. And what happens as countries become better off, their populations are able to spend more money, they buy junk food, they don't travel as much on foot, they go in cars and on motorbikes. And so really what we are seeing is a change in lifestyle here in India. And on top of that, Indians seem to be predisposed towards getting diabetes. And there is virtually no public information. So there are millions and millions of people in India who have absolutely no idea what diabetes can do.
And, of course, one of the management issues for diabetes is compliance, making sure people monitor their blood and maintain their insulin levels. How difficult is that for a nation like India?
I mean, for some in India, it's a non-starter. But you're right. Compliance is the key thing. And if diabetes type 2 in particular is caught before it develops, it can be arrested. But what is happening is people are starting to lose their sight, they're starting to lose limbs, they're getting heart disease, all symptoms of diabetes. They're not aware what they're getting. They're going late to their physicians to get treatment. And this epidemic is, as I say, cutting a huge swathe through the population here.
And what kinds of things is the Indian government doing to address the issue?
Frankly, not much at the moment. I mean, they've talked about a public information campaign, and that is what's needed. Every Indian needs to know the dangers of diabetes and how to avoid getting diabetes. And the other very worrying thing here is that diabetes formerly had been seen to affect people in their middle age or who are elderly. But we are now seeing in India young people at the age of 13, 14, 15 getting type 2 diabetes. This is pretty much unheard of. And of course, that in itself holds some very, very nasty omens for the future.
Adam Minot, thank you for joining us. Adam Minot is a BBC World Affairs correspondent. He was coming to us from Chennai, India, and he was talking about World Diabetes Day.
That's a huge epidemiological story there in the developing world.
That percentage is quite staggering. 14% of a billion people is very big.
Well, and diabetes, as Dr. Pardis was talking about on the program earlier this week, is an enormous strain on our healthcare system. You can only imagine the strain in India.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, November 14th, and Mark Garrison has the latest headlines of the hour. Mark?
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, we heard his name a lot on the campaign trail, but not his voice. Now former weatherman Bill Ayers is finally talking. He was just on Good Morning America. He didn't talk much about President-elect Obama, but did defend his anti-war actions.
And I really urge people to participate in resistance, in nonviolent direct action to these wars. I don't urge violence at all, but let's admit that we live often in a sewer of violence, and opposing that violence is key.
He's not the new weatherman on Good Morning America.
No, we're speaking of the Weather Underground.
I see. Yes.
The group that placed bombs around various places in the country many years ago. He's now a professor of education at the University of Illinois in Chicago. The Eurozone has gone into recession for the first time in its history. Newly released figures show that the bloc, which is made up of the 15 countries using the euro, has seen its economy contract for two consecutive quarters. At a meeting in France, French President Nicolas Sarkozy has told Russia's Dmitry Medvedev that he has to prove that Russia has fully complied with its promise to fully withdraw from the Republic of Georgia before they make further moves on talks. In Mexico, crime reporter Armando Rodriguez was shot to death in front of his home yesterday. He worked for the newspaper El Diario and had covered crime in the violent border town of Juarez for a decade. He is the fifth journalist killed this year. And representatives from seven sports, including golf, rugby, and squash, are making their case to Olympic officials that they should be in the 2016 Games. And very quickly, Femi Okeh is not here, but we do have another kind of a British moment. So to send this out to her, let's just play a little bit of this and tell you what's happening. So the latest Bond movie, Quantum of Solace, is out today, and it's the 22nd film, but it's probably the most pretentious title they've ever done there before. Daniel Craig is currently Bond, and it's gotten pretty good reviews so far.
You know, Femi's always doing country music on the show. I don't associate her with British at all.
She picked the last George Strait song I would pick. I wanted something from his earlier back catalog, but I guess that was the newsiest thing.
For you close listeners to The Takeaway, thank you, Mark Garrison. So, Quantum of Solace, no. In this segment, we're going to take a look at what's going on in the city of Las Vegas. It's part of our regional looks at the impact of the recession as it builds across the United States. And why look at Las Vegas? Well, it's a community that's both a bellwether and very, very unusual. It's one of the fastest growing in the United States as a result of home building that took place in Las Vegas over the last decade. It's also a center of foreclosures and a place where debt was very much on the horizon. And, of course, because of the Las Vegas Strip, the gambling and the entertainment that takes place in that town, it's a place where shrinking disposable income is, very much of a problem. If people don't have as much disposable income, they're not entertaining themselves in Las Vegas. And so here to talk about this is Ian Milchrist, a business reporter for the State of Nevada, a public affairs show on KNPR. It's a public radio member station in Las Vegas. Ian, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
It seems to me you have a very interesting perch for viewing the real Main Street implications of this economic downturn. What kinds of things, first of all, have you seen, and where can you go to take a look at some of these impacts?
Well, you can see it pretty much anywhere. I mean, if you've been out here in the last couple of years, you know that the strip casinos are usually packed on the weekends. Not anymore. You walk through the casinos, there's a lot more tables just not being played, dealers standing around waiting for work. There's arguments now with cab drivers over tips that they get from the strip clubs because they are fighting for customers, and the tips are a huge part of their income now. And in the suburbs out here where real people live, there's just lots of vacancies, foreclosure notices, stores closing. It's really hitting the town hard.
Here's someone who actually called into your program, State of Nevada, on in early November, actually really right after the election, and it was not a terribly hopeful voice about what happens when you lose your job in Las Vegas.
A lot of people quit, and a lot of people resort to doing things that they normally wouldn't do, which would be taking a longer route to make up the difference. So the tourist or the riding public is now paying for things, because when it comes down to feeding your family, you're going to do what you have to do.
Now, she's a taxicab driver and is definitely noticing changes in the behavior of riders in Las Vegas. Who else did you talk to?
Well, we've also talked to employees at restaurants and at some of the gentlemen's cabarets, as they call them, and all of those people are saying that the tips are down a long, long way. And you've got to remember, the real income for people working in this town comes from tips. I mean, dealers get paid minimum wage, and if people aren't playing at their table, they're not going to get the tips that really make their income a livable wage.
Now, you talked about strip clubs. You're referring to clubs on the Las Vegas Strip. So there are very much, tips associated with people who deal at the tables, people who, take drinks from waiters and waitresses and restaurant staff, if they're sitting in front of the slot machines. And, of course, then there's the tip issue for someone like Darian Gibson.
In September of last year, I was averaging somewhere around $700 or $800 a day every time I worked, to the point now where I'm lucky to make $100 or $150. I considered a $200 day or a $300 day to be actually a pretty decent day, a success.
Now, the fortunes of an exotic dancer in Las Vegas may seem like, something to, giggle about. But in fact, it really is an indicator of declining disposable income, right?
Exactly, because and all the official statistics tell us this, that there's way fewer visitors. The number of people flying through the airport is dropping by 5 or 10% every month. And that means that there are less people. And even when they come, they're much less likely to gamble and much less likely to leave big tips on the table.
The casino industry has never been an industry that has been accused of being laid back. Are they launching any kind of assertive campaigns to draw in more people, or at least make that effort?
Well, the Convention and Visitors Authority did run a campaign a few months ago urging people to just come now, in essence saying, don't wait. There's no time like the present to come get a vacation, even if things aren't looking great. We don't know whether that added some extra visitors, but all the lines are down, down, down in terms of numbers. But the other thing to notice here is that the strips, big hotels, are offering enormous bargains. Rooms in those luxury places like Bellagio and the Venetian that used to go for $300 or $400 a night, you can pick them up on the web now, and often on the hotel's own website for $100, $120.
Wow, that's an amazing response to the crisis. There's also big news in the management suites of some of the entertainment companies there. Sands appears to be teetering on bankruptcy, and there was a giant management departure from the MGM Grand.
Well, that's right. MGM is saying that was just a routine. The guy is 65, Terry Laney, and he was due to leave anyway. Unfortunately for him, it happened the same day the Wall Street Journal announced that he really didn't have an MBA, but that's a whole other story. The Sands had an enormous building program both on the Strip here, and they were building, believe it or not, $20 billion worth of casinos in Macau in southern China. And they just found that both in China and here, the fall off in tourism is so drastic, they weren't making the revenue to pay back those bonds.
Big economic impacts.
And they've just halted their building program. In China, they fired 11,000 construction workers, and construction is grinding to a halt all along the Strip here.
I want you to listen to one last voice here, Ian, before we go.
For me, I basically put myself as recession-proof entertainer only because I got several, identities I go by. I'm a massage therapist, I'm a domina, and I'm an entertainer. So those three covering those areas seems to have helped me kept myself pretty consistent with everything that I've been doing.
That's what an exotic dancer does to deal with a recession. Can you be recession-proof in Las Vegas before we go, Ian?
No, you can't. I mean, it used to be that you could because we were the only place that had gambling. But since we've become a place where people come for luxury shopping, fine dining, a big resort, there's so many people come here now. And when they are sitting on their wallets, the town goes into nosedive.
Well, a fascinating MRI into the economic health of the community of Las Vegas. Ian Milchrist, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
You know, it's sort of depressing to think that you can't fall back on that dominatrix thing, even in Las Vegas anymore. Ian Milchrist is a business reporter for KNPR, a public radio member station in Nevada. His program is State of Nevada.
You know, John, we actually got a thought from one of our listeners on that story.
Hi, this is Carmen from Hudson County, New Jersey. Senior citizen, my senior citizen friends and I go down to Atlantic City once a month, every month, to have a good time. But the casinos are so eager to making money that they raise the prices on the food. They raise the prices on the bus to go down to Atlantic City, and they give no prizes. If you go down now, it's empty.
Huh. Thanks for that. Next week, we're going to be taking a look at debt. In other words, people are trying to pay that off as opposed to making money. So we want to hear your story. Are you in debt? How much are you in debt, and how are you managing that? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
This weekend, we're going to get spanked. And you know something? Given the mess we've created, we deserve it.
Dominatrix getting spanked. What a weekend we're going to have here on The Takeaway. That's Peter Morici, University of Maryland School of Business professor. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.